How can I get over or release the outrage I, among others, feel about the political situation in the United States? Bush and his policies, which led to the invasion of Iraq, the dismantlement of the US social services and civil liberties. Should I really let go, release this outrage? Outrage, I assume, is a kind of anger. There are many places where you can look in this world, countries, places, institutions, governments, and you see varying degrees of human unconsciousness at work. Wherever you look, you see the manifestation of human unconsciousness. Unconsciousness, of course, I'm not saying they are totally they are identified with the mind and the old patterns of the mind, the collective ego. And wherever you look still, you see it, because the change that is happening in humanity to a large extent is on the inner. It only slowly reaches the outer levels where you can actually detect it. It takes a while before it reaches an institution, before it reaches a politician, before it reaches somebody in a position of power, but occasionally it already happens. Russia had a relatively enlightened human being after having had succession of leaders who seemed, you didn't even know whether they were alive or dead when you saw them, when they were having their, there was actually speculation. Is whoever, Brezhnev or whoever the names were, is he still alive, or did they just put a puppet there that went? And some others speculated that there was an actor acting, because they didn't dare say that he had died, so they gave an actor the role to play. And this maybe have been true, we don't know. And that's one form of unconsciousness, and the entire the structure of that regime was started from an ideal. The mind saw something beautiful. We must have equality, no personal possessions. But nothing had changed in the human mind. The structures were still in place, so we got that instead. And then suddenly there was Gorbachev, who compared to the previous leaders was a Buddha in consciousness. I remember once a remark he made on television when he was still president. They asked, there was a little scandal about some Western spies and Eastern spies had been thrown out of the country, some the usual thing. And what about this scandal about the Russian spies in the Russian embassy? And he said, well, as the wise man said, this too will pass. And it did. However, it is rare for this shift that is happening in human consciousness to reach the outer forms, the institutions, the political, the government, the institutions, whatever it may be, the outer forms, businesses, the way businesses are run, companies, in most cases, they're dominated still by the old egoic consciousness. And I've spoken to some people who work in corporations, who say there's so much infighting and useless power struggles going on within the corporation, it's a miracle that anything gets done at all. And everybody lives in fear and they're not happy. So wherever you look in the world, you'll find still on the surface of things varying degrees of unconsciousness. And only occasionally something else comes through already here and there. It does. Even on television, sometimes you see it. You see there's a conscious being speaking or a film that has a message pointing to conscious awareness or pointing to stillness. It happens. Maybe it happens more now. It's happening more. It's always wonderful. I love it when I see a film that points to the truth. And there are quite a few now. Not the majority yet, of course. But there are so many things that you could feel angry about if you personalize human unconsciousness. If you make it into an identity, then you say, these dreadful bastards, look what they are doing. Human unconsciousness. Jesus saw it clearly when he said, they know not what they do. In other words, they are unconscious. And so a country sometimes also can vary. A country can be pulled into unconsciousness to some extent by an unconscious leader. Germany is a best example of what happened there. A country that, compared to others on the planet, was one of the most highly developed, cultured, scientifically, literature, culture, philosophy, music, and all that to no avail. They dropped right down into unconsciousness. Back. But this wouldn't have happened if there had not been a strong, enormous amount of collective pain body still in the country and an enormous amount of collective ego despite the so-called cultural achievements. So when you see it as unconsciousness, you're less likely to feel angry about it because anger does not really fulfill a very useful purpose. It doesn't really change things. It contributes more. You're being pulled into unconsciousness through anger. You become unconscious yourself. See it for what it is. And then the next step is, what can you do? You have to accept that this is so, which does not mean there's nothing you can do. Once you have accepted that there's still a considerable amount of unconsciousness here on the planet, wherever you see it, wherever you feel it's mostly, you feel called upon to do something in this or that area. It could be the destruction of nature. It could be the polluting of oceans and rivers. It could be on the political scene, American politics, other politics, Middle East. Great focal point of unconsciousness. It's just look at the situation there. The instinct is no stop, no pause to the fighting between the two. And they're both victims of the other. And they're both totally convinced that they're victims of the other. So when you see it, then you can point out certain things. Write, speak to people, have a website, that says the truth about such and such, so and so, and just state the facts that as they are. This is how it is. If you want to, you can stand at a street corner and hold up something, a sign. A few people may start talking to you. They are more likely to listen if you are not angry, but simply explain, look, this is how it is. They are more likely to watch your website if it doesn't have the screaming anger about it. You're not convincing anybody who has the opposite view to yours, who says Bush is the greatest leader that has happened to America in a long time. You're not going to convince them with your anger that you are right. Anger will, their own position will become more entrenched. And so if you're right, then state the facts. This is how it is. Explain. If you can see the futility of anger, it's more likely to drop away. And there's something more powerful then. You can speak with passion, without anger, but passion, about what you feel is true. Be aware, very careful with identifying with mental positions, though, when you do that. Identifying with a position as me or us against. Be very careful with making wrong others, groups of people, or individuals, because it draws you back into unconsciousness. Don't personalize it in that way. When doing projects of any sort, large or small, I find I must keep my intent fiercely in mind or I end up doing something else. By employing this fierce focus, am I actually being counterproductive in the long run or in the big picture? The focus, when you have a project that needs to be done, finished. Now, the questioner is saying, keeping my intent fiercely in mind. Now, the intent, I assume, is where you want to get to, the finished project, the point that you want to arrive at to get it done. So my intent is getting to that point where the project is finished. My intent is drawing up a plan, a business plan, or the architect does a building, draws up a huge high-rise office building, or whatever, or there may be a project of any kind that you need to finish. There's the intent, and that's very much, I compare to a journey. When you're traveling from here to there, maybe you're walking, let's say the rudimentary form, the early form of journeying, of being on a pilgrimage or journeying. Tourists didn't exist at that time. It was unknown. The people would journey because they had to leave their country or they went on some kind of army expedition or pilgrimage, spiritual journey. That was perhaps the most common journey that individuals would undertake, pilgrimage. You know where you need to go. The question is, what is it that takes up most of your attention, the place that you need to get to or the step you're taking at this moment? What's more important? Now, in many cases these days, what people are obsessed with is the outcome where they need to get to. And that causes the stress. I need to get this done, finished, over with. And I'm on a limited time scale here. Can't waste any minute. It needs to get done. I need to. So there's an excessive projection to the finished end product, the point in the future that I need to get to. And then the doing itself, it is done in a hurried way. Arrest, there's the energy. Okay, come on, what's the next? It doesn't matter what you're doing. Let's say you have to complete something that you manufacture with your hands. But this thing has to be ready by tomorrow. The world is mad these days. It always tells you this. You have no time. You have to do it by tomorrow. And so you become excessively focused on tomorrow. I have to get this, the finished product. Or you're thinking that I can sell this. When it's finished, I can sell it. So it's done quickly with the end in mind. The end takes over your mind, occupies your mind more than the present moment, and you reduce the present moment to a means to an end. That's how a lot of doing happens these days. And all that doing is of low quality. Any doing that reduces this moment to a means to an end to a future moment is not high quality doing. And you can observe that when you observe how a person works, whether they are totally attentive, give total attention to whatever they are doing at this moment, which does not mean that they don't know where they are going to in their project. That is peripherally in their field of attention. The point they want to get to is peripherally in their field of attention, like a traveler who is walking towards Rome, let's say, and they are taking this step and are fully conscious of each step they are taking, but peripherally they know where they are going. It's over there. It's a long way away, a long way, but they know it's over there. So the focal point of there is the quality of your step at this moment, because if you're not careful, you'll stumble. You'll never get to Rome. The quality of each step is what matters. And the getting is secondary. It is on the periphery. You have the goal in mind also. But no, it does not occupy your mind. It does not overpower you. And so then the present moment is not a means to an end. You give your full attention to this moment. I have seen a few, not many, and some of them are highly so-called effective and successful people, who did not become successful through strain and stress. Some did, and they are very unhappy and won't be around for long. But I observed a few who, whoever they meet, whoever they talk to, or whatever is presented to them, they are totally there with it. If you come to them and ask them a question, they may be high up, so to speak, in social terms, the CEO of this or that corporation, and somebody comes to them, and there are a few, not many, who will give you total attention, no matter who you are. And that is wonderful. Everybody loves doing what they tell them to do because they feel so valued, because attention is the greatest gift you can give. Full attention. You're acknowledging that human being beyond the roles that they play in the world. So they're giving everything their fullest attention, and they are extremely effective at what they do. Others look as if they were effective, but everything they do is contaminated with extremely stressful, raw energy that is really a form of suffering. And they spread unhappiness. So it is possible to work effectively, in fact, more effectively, by focusing on what it is at hand here, right now, to do, without losing in your peripheral vision the place you need to get to. That remains. Here, there. One step, Rome is there. But this step is here, and this step is more important. Whenever you see any work of quality that's been made by a human being, it means some attention must have gone into it, some human attention. Somewhere there must have been someone who did not reduce the moment in which that was being made to a means to an end, where it gave. So you have works of art that have that quality, handicraft, things made by artisans in the original way, not under stress of having to produce. Because attention is also loving care. Another aspect of attention is whatever you give attention to, there is a loving care that flows into the doing. So if you give attention to a human being that comes into the now, the field of now, and this is so beautiful, to give each human being that comes into your field of vision to you with this or that demand or question or whatever it may be, give them full and complete attention. That doesn't mean you get drawn into their story. You don't give attention necessarily to their mind stream and energize that. You simply give attention. There's a spaciousness. There is the awareness, the current of awareness flows into the looking. The same way you look at a tree, you hold. And that is beautiful. So see how things work in that new way. And observe, if you can find anybody who is present in doing something, observe them. It's wonderful to watch somebody at work in that way. And it won't really be perceived as work by them. It's joyful. This is one question that has appeared about 10 times in different forms. How would you suggest imparting these teachings to children?
Lesson 5, continued on disc 7.
This is one question that has appeared about 10 times in different forms. How would you suggest imparting these teachings to children? I assume that either you live with children, or that you work with children, or that you may have the desire perhaps to write a book for children, whatever. If you live with children or work with children, then of course primary in imparting the teachings to children is not through words but through living the teaching. Especially applies if you have children at home. If you live presence, if you embody living presence, then they will catch it from you. And you don't need to say that much, but there may be moments when they are receptive, and perhaps a word or two may come out of your mouth pointing to presence, because the children live in a culture that knows as yet nothing of presence. It is likely that they go to a school that is dominated by nervous mind energy, unless you have chosen already a relatively conscious school for them. They do exist here and there. But if not, if they are still part of the mainstream culture, then in a way you need to counteract that at home. That otherwise they will be very nervous children, because school is making them tense, stressed, and nervous. So most homes lack presence, and when you go in there you see in many cases it's a madhouse. It's your job to bring in presence. And again, we come back now to what we just spoke of in the previous question, giving your children your fullest attention. is the greatest gift. Many parents these days never listen to their children because they have that's the next thing already that they need to do, and they are busy anyway. How was school? Oh, okay. And what do you have to do now? Okay. Never, when in the listening, it doesn't matter so much what the children are telling you. What matters is that you, the space that arises as you listen. The spacious presence that arises as you listen to the child. Giving them space to be. Oh. That's how the teachings are imparted. By living it in that way. Perhaps also certain things, if you have very young children, where the mind is just starting up in them, to see if you can keep them aware that words and concepts are never the reality, are not everything. Particularly at a stage when they demand to be fed with words and concepts. When they're at the age where they ask, what's this? What's that for? What's that? And 100 times a day they ask, what's that? Because they're quickly, the mind is absorbing. It needs to do that, it seems. The mind is absorbing words. It wants to know. But the openness also disappears. So when you teach new words and or show them this is that, what's this? There's so much you can say about this leaf to a child instead of saying, it's a leaf. As you say it, you put it in the child's hand. You encourage the child to look so that the child does not stop looking the moment he or she has learned the word. Because that's what the mind does. The true looking isn't happening anymore. The word takes the place of the reality. It becomes immediately a screen. And so that to reduce that, when you explain as much as you can, you may not be able to do it all the time, but when you explain something, stay with the reality, and perhaps instead of saying, it's a leaf, you say, we call it a leaf. Because it's not a leaf. This is the illusion that when you attach a word to something, you know what it is. You have no idea what it is, you've just attached a word to it. And that's how people live. They live in this make-believe world that they know. All they have is a collection of labels. And so that doesn't happen to the child. See, if, as you teach language and words and concepts, see if you can keep the child in touch with the reality that is more alive, deeper, more mysterious than any concept. And here you can teach so much. You can teach the child to, can you see the colors? And the, can you see the shadings here? Isn't it beautiful? Can you feel that? Yes, it's called a leaf, but can you feel it? Can you see the colors? And do you know what's happening to it? No. Why is it so beautiful? What's happening to it? It's dying. It's dying. Soon it'll be gone. And then the child may ask another, dying? What's that? Well, I'm not saying what words will come out of your mouth, because you will be present at that moment. But then through this little thing where before you said, that's a leaf, it's all, or you might even know what tree it is, so you have attached another label to it. So you can give labels, the mind needs it, but there's far more. Always remind the child, point out that which is beyond the words and concepts. And so that would be wonderful for a child to grow up in that way, so that the mind is not totally possessed by words and concepts. So it remains, the seeing remains, the hearing remains. You hear bird, and then encourage the child to hear more, to hear. Can you hear? Encourage. And children will be receptive to that. Of course, there are many things in our culture that are there to stimulate the mind, to draw them out of their body. To teach a child to feel the body, they are very ready to feel that, make it into a little game. Can you feel the inner body? Can you feel the aliveness that's there? And they can, and they will love it. And then, if possible, reduce the amount of gadgets they play with, because they are all work on the level of abstraction. Computer screens, video game screens, TV, pulling them out of their body, pulling their attention out into some hypnotic trance that gives them a secondary feeling of false aliveness. The video game. So much so that when they stop playing, they don't feel alive anymore. What's the I need some other fix now. This is what the culture is doing to the children. I need another stimulus, another fix, otherwise they will feel dead. And then they look for the next thing, and there's plenty of things. Switch something on, put headphones on. And then you teach the children about the pain body. Children have them too. Some more than others. So when the child goes into a rage or a screaming fit, or maybe the pain body will take a different form, the child totally withdraws into a corner and doesn't want to talk anymore. At the slightest thing might provoke the pain body. It's the same with adults. And there's then far more pain than you could ever have imagined coming out of that little situation. Some children become screaming monsters for a few minutes. In the middle of it, you can't say anything. But when it subsided, you can say, what was that? Where did that come from? What did that feel like? Does it feel good? And so you can direct attention within when the pain body is not active. And then say, do you think it may happen again? Shall we see if it happens again? And we can catch it when just it starts. And next time, you can see, child starts, oh, is it back? Maybe it has a name. The red big monster back? Oh, can you feel it? Not at that point, whether they say they can feel it or not depends to what extent the pain body has already taken possession of their mind. If they scream at you when you ask, can you feel it? Then it's too late to feel it. Or they throw something. And then again afterwards, you say, what was that? It was back, wasn't it? And then you say, did you notice that mummy or daddy also has that? Do you remember the other day when mummy screamed at you, or mummy dropped something and started shouting and screaming at daddy? Threw him out of the house. It
Yes.
That was the same thing. Mummy didn't catch it then either. And so how wonderful if a child can grow up in a conscious environment, family, surroundings that way. Not necessarily totally enlightened, just conscious. Not necessarily a family with continuous and permanent peace throughout. So that is imparting the teaching to children. Present moment, direct their attention, redirect their attention to present moment again and again. This, to looking, to listening, to touching. Away from how you reduce the amount they spend addicted to the screens and electronic things, you have to somehow do it and replace it with something more vital, more alive. And they can feel that it's more vital and more alive. Pain bodies have an enormous capacity to pull you in. Even the pain body of a child has that already. When it starts screaming, it wants a negative reaction from you. That's what the pain body always wants. Give me more pain. And so it requires considerable presence to hold the space. And many parents just should, they're completely flabbergasted when the angel turns into a monster. What is going on here? And then they react. The more unconscious they are, the stronger, the more violent their reaction will be. Their own pain body reacts. They know not what they do. There are several questions. There was just one here and about six or seven others. On prayer, the use of prayer, how to use it, whether to use it at all. Now, that word can mean many different things. It can mean going to church and saying, please, God, let me have that job. I promise I'll be good. If you only let me have that job. I practiced that as a child. Please, let there be some peace in my family. Didn't work. So from somebody who went to church every Sunday, then at 12, I must have decided that there was no point anymore. But there are many different kinds of prayer. There are petitionary prayers. You would like something. They may sometimes work, but you never know whether it was the prayer or you would have gotten it anyway. There are more effective ways if you really feel that you need and want something, but be careful, it won't make you happy, but that's another story. If you really feel you want something, you can use affirmation and visualization. And when you get it, enjoy it. Don't look for yourself in it. Don't look to it for deep inner fulfillment or some kind of permanently enhanced sense of self or permanent happiness. Nothing that you achieve can give you that. Knowing that, you can play around with the world of form. And Jesus already explained how to pray for something, and that is where he said, when you pray for something, feel as if you already had it, as if it had already been given. So you're not saying, I want something, because if you say, I want something, it affirms a lack. It says on the other side, the unexpressed side, I don't have it. So when you say, I want it, you're also stating that you don't have it. So you're praying at the same time not to have it. If you affirm and visualize that it is already here, and you feel as if you had it, that the feeling that you want to get from it, you already have that feeling, and that's the truth. Because you're imagining that it's going to give you feelings of peace or happiness, which is always in you already, if you go inside deep enough. But I don't want to discourage you from playing around in the world of form. So why not try it out? Visualize that it is already yours. You have it, and you feel what you feel as you have it. Thank you for giving me that. It's beautiful, whatever it may be. The house, you're already in it, feels good. Thank you. It's nice to have that house. Thanks. Yeah. It's already there. It's more likely to manifest in that way. And then you move in and you go from there. Then you sit there. You feel, oh, great, I've got it. And then the old mind patterns come up in the new house. Then there are other prayers that are used, they're all in different religions, and they can be called pointers. They are more advanced prayers. They are pointers to a particular state. It's not that uttering those words produces magically the state. What matters when you utter certain words or prayers, then most of them are short, is really the stillness that comes after that. Buddhism, for example, has the metta meditation, which is a kind of prayer, which starts with, I believe, may everybody on this planet be well and happy. And then after you've uttered those words, there's a stillness. And then it says, may everybody in this country be well and happy. Metta means loving kindness, and then there's a stillness. May every being in this city be well and happy. Stillness. May everybody in this house be well and happy. May I be well and happy. And it takes you into stillness. And the being of well and happy is already there in the stillness. It's there, it spreads. You could become still, it would spread anyway, even without the words. Because whatever state of consciousness you are in affects the totality, and in turn is the totality manifesting through you. And we have the beautiful Christian prayer by Saint Francis, I believe. Let me be an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love, and so on. Where there is injury, pardon, and so on. And those prayers are openings. They open a door. And they take you into stillness. And they are beautiful. Most prayers operate still on the level of duality. Even when you say, "Let me be an instrument of thy peace," you are still using the language of duality. There's me, and thy, presumably, is God. There is me, and there is God. So God is perceived still as something or someone separate from me. Nevertheless, it's a beautiful prayer. And if stillness follows the prayer, in the stillness you have transcended duality. There is, some of you are familiar with the Course in Miracles. Course in Miracles, many of those lessons are a kind of prayer. And most of the lessons in it operate on the level of duality, speaking of God as He and addressing God as something or someone outside of you. Course in Miracles meets you where you are on the level of duality, but as you reach the end of the Course, without you noticing it, the lessons become more non-dualistic. And in the end, you end up in stillness. And it says, the use for words is almost over now. It's towards the end of the Course. So it meets you where you are and takes you by the hand. It only works if you can get hold, if Christian terminology is appealing to you. To some it is not, and then there are many other ways. Don't use something that you don't like, the form of which you don't like. So most prayers are dualistic, and then you can have, although the metta prayer in Buddhism is, may all beings be well and happy, is fine. There's no duality really there, although you're still saying there are many beings. Ultimately, there's only oneness. But what can you do? You're using language. And then there are short things that are almost like mantras, just single words. Peace, for example. The word itself doesn't produce peace, but it is a pointer. Stillness. One of the most beautiful pointers to be found in the Old Testament: be still and know that I am God. And this is why, if we can call that a prayer, it is a kind of prayer. It is a prayer where duality is transcended. And it is a miraculous prayer, the words of which it consists are all synonyms for one single thing. Be still. Know I am God. Be being. One being. Sat in Sanskrit. Being and stillness are one. It is the stillness of being itself before it comes into existence as something. Be still. Know. In the stillness that is being, there is a deep knowing, non-conceptual, a deep intelligence, not words, not thoughts, deeper than thought, because it's the primordial seed of all intelligence. Be still. Know I am. It is the innermost sense of beingness, or I am. God, the divine, the source, the one. And you put these words together, each word signifies also the other. They're all one. Be still, know I am God. miraculous. So that those are advanced prayers and powerful. They put you in touch. Be still and know that I am God is one of the most powerful and beautiful pointers to the truth, and one of those rare ones that uses language without taking you into duality. Please talk more about the pain body and how to transcend it. We already spoke a little bit, but there are so many questions about the pain body that we may, in tomorrow's session, talk a little bit more about it, unless something else arises in that now. Last one, perhaps, because they're cutting off the satellite dish. As someone who has done a lot of yoga and body work for many years, I always felt there was some correlation between spirituality and good posture. Then I saw you. What a shock. My first thought was, how can somebody with your posture be so blooming spiritually, and wouldn't you be even more spiritual? If you did some corrective body work. My second thought was that I'm a blooming idiot. And can you tell us how you experience the body and if it ever feels like an impediment to you? That reminds me of I talked to Gangaji, the spiritual teacher, a couple of years ago, and she was telling me she was doing some kind of body work years ago, I can't remember what kind. But at that time she heard of Ramana Maharshi and became interested in the teachings and read a book. And then she saw a photo of him, and she saw that and said, a man who has such bad posture can possibly have nothing to teach me. He will certainly have nothing to teach me if he walks like that. And it took her several years to transcend that belief. And then she saw that it didn't matter anymore. Sometimes, if the body has gone through a lot of suffering, either physical suffering or psychological suffering, it leaves traces in the body, in the very bones of the body, it leaves traces. In some cases, it's in the face. I knew one spiritual teacher, I won't say who said, look at my face. I always look unhappy even when I'm happy, I look unhappy. And that is because I've been unhappy. I was unhappy for so many years. He didn't really. He only looked unhappy if you saw the external features of his face. If you looked more deeply, you could see he wasn't unhappy. But you could see the lines in his face that showed that were the traces left behind by unhappiness. But something else had was now shining through it, through that the form that had been affected by the suffering. And that's the same here. People are surprised when I tell them it's very rare that I ever feel any pain in the body. Only 2 years ago I was at Omega, I had a back pain. I don't know what that was to do with. Maybe the events in New York. I don't know. But usually there's no pain, the body feels fine. And it doesn't seem to be a problem at all. And something else shines through it. So the body has fulfilled its function of being an opening for that. Now, I'm not saying that in many other cases, body work is a wonderful thing to free emotions that may be stuck there. Even the pain body, it's beautiful. It's not ultimately, it could happen to anyone at any moment. It could happen to somebody who is totally crippled. And that has happened too. There was a famous enlightened poet, a teacher who hundreds of years ago wrote the Indian scripture called the Ashtavakra Gita. And he is said to have been a cripple. And it didn't matter anymore. That was his suffering, traces left behind by the suffering. And then the body simply became something through which presence shines. I'll put these back in the basket. I'm sorry, your question hasn't come up yet. There are many. Thank you. Thank you. Stay a little while, both here and if you're still there, Austin, Hollyhock. Stay a little while with the empty chair or the empty screen. Thank you.
This concludes lesson 5.